Welcome, everyone, to our third session on the Civil War with Anne Morris. This has just been such a good series, and you can watch it online whenever they put them up if you miss it, or share it with your friends, because I know someone in the office told me she sent the information to her son because he's a real Civil War buff, and he had enjoyed learning about the topic. So, Anne, will you begin us with prayer?
Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you, Sarah. I've enjoyed my time with you as well, all. It's good to be among friends. Let's pray. Gracious God, we are so thankful for this weather and for signs of spring. Winter is great, but I've just had enough of it. But be with us now in this hour, that the material would be useful for our understanding of our history and the current life that we lead as Christians. In Christ's name we ask, amen. I was, I was corrected by my husband this week that I was wrong in introducing last week's session of history of an infantry by using the bugle church call. Bugle calls were only used by the cavalry. So the infantry used drums. So I did find a recording of fife and drum of the church call online. So Ted, can you roll that for us now? Thank you. I liked that one a lot better. It was more lively, more positive. I want to repeat, or at least emphasize, that my aim in these 4 weeks of lectures is to help us to see the issue of the development of religion, including the black slavery, as we're dealing with this week, rather than in hindsight, to see it as it developed, stage by stage. Because if we look at slavery in the 21st century, we think, duh, what was the big deal? Why did it take so much strife and years to settle the issue? Well, there were a lot of issues involved in that. It was, as I hope I've explained, it was a hard thing for a lot of people to give up. And it took a lot of changes within the people before it really could get enough emphasis to be addressed. And I've noticed that when I ask people whether they have had relatives in the Civil War or where they come from, North or South, the people from the South sort of say, I'm from the South. As if they had some sort of embarrassment for their people's, their family's situation and their position against slavery, or about the South dragging, or I shouldn't say dragging, I don't want to make a judgment, but about their emphasis and their issues with slavery. But I don't think you should do that. I think we should understand that the South had a lot to give up, a lot to lose with the reversal of slavery. And they weren't the only ones who held slaves. There were slaves in the United States in the North. It took a long time for slavery to be even addressed in the North. It was not, when they first had legislation in the North by the states, it wasn't an immediate freedom for slaves. It was a gradual freedom. They would free children first in a certain number of years. So nobody was without sin. Today we're going to be talking about the slave religion. And I'm using as a primary resource a book by a man by the name of Rabiteau. He is a black man. He's no longer living. But this book, one of his books, was written, I believe, published in 1978. And the reason why he was a good resource or a seminal researcher is that he brings the perspective of seeing slave religion from the slave perspective themselves, rather than the white man or white people looking at black religion from a white person's standpoint. There are differences in their perspectives. So he did the research going into the testimony of slaves, primarily in the earliest you could get would be in the Caribbean slaves and their testimony. So let's begin with the non-African religion in Africa. There was some Islam mission through Africa, but not very much. So there were a few Muslims who were enslaved in the United States. And remember that Christianity wasn't really established in Africa until the late 1800s. There may have been Christianity there because there were Europeans who were into the African trade, slavery before then, very early, but they weren't there to Christianize the Africans. They were there for economic reasons. So what was religion in Africa? Yes, they did have religion before coming to the New World. But just generally, each geographic area from which they were enslaved had their own religion. They were different names for gods. But they shared some things. So let me just start with the things that they shared. They did believe in one main creator god, the god who created the world, but it was more of a deity religion in the sense that that god had stepped back after creation and left the rest of the religious ideas and activity to lesser gods. And that's one reason why the Roman Catholicism missions in the Caribbean, which the Spanish people went to in order for economic gain, that's why their mission was a little bit more successful, because the blacks could buy into or understand the ideas of saints with particular emphasis, patron saints of this and that, that followed in with their ideas of their gods. Nature, many of these lesser gods were like the Native American gods. They reflected nature a lot, wind, water, moons, and human events such as birth and death. These lesser gods could be for good, or they could be malevolent, causing bad things to happen to people or protecting their people. They believed in a soul. Humans had a physical body as well as a soul. After death, their souls went to a heavenly place. And or if they didn't go to a heavenly place, they were reborn into the lives of the future generations, into lives of newborn children, or they would come down generations later. So if there were physical semblances between a grandson and the grandfather. They would say that the grandfather's soul had inhabited that grandson, or physical traits, or even characteristics of their personality or mannerisms, if they would remember something in the baby or in the young child, they reminded them of their fathers or grandfathers, they would say that this was be inhabiting the body of that person, younger person. They believed in spirit possession. Spirits could be, for good reasons, inhabit a person. The religion would emphasize trances and ecstatic dances and prayers and songs so that it would invoke spirits to come into their presence in their religion. That was called being in the spirit. Funerals, bodies of dead were handled with great ceremony and respect. But one thing that Rabiteau emphasized in his book throughout was the flexibility of the religious life of Black people. It's called, and it happens in religions that go from one geographic place to another, it's called syncretism. It happens to Christianity when Christians would go to, let's say, the Asian locations. They often would adopt some of the local religious symbols, such as the lotus flower. So the African religions were not static, as maybe we can think about in comparison to the white man's, the European religions that became institutionalized in order to make it to be uncorrupted, to have creeds and to have statements of faith that would solidify what was supposed to be thought and what was right in religious beliefs. But the Black religion, out of respect for spiritual power, wherever it happened, however it happened, they would recognize that it was there. And they were open to combining different forms of religious practices and tokens and religious rituals to their own, or the ones that they found where they had been transported to. So what was it like in the Caribbean religion or the Caribbean faith of the slaves? I think it in time, the religious or the transportation of slaves came first to the Caribbean, or and also they came to Brazil. That might have been a shorter trade route for some reason. And a very small minority of the slaves came directly to the northern areas of America, maybe as low as 14%. So the majority came from the Caribbean, I suppose, because they sought other economic ideas or opportunities, the white folks. But when they were imported into the Caribbean area, or into this different place, one of the white slave traders' techniques or strategies was to prevent any of the established connections between these Black people to stand together. They broke them up. They broke up families. If the husband and wife happened to come over together, or if they had social groups together, they would break them up. And this was a technique that the slave masters in the South also incorporated into their treatment of their slaves. The Spanish and the Portuguese were the ones who brought the slaves to the Caribbean area. So that was the influence and where the Roman Catholic people came from, Roman Catholic institutions came from. Voodoo came from Haiti. I remember going to Louisiana, and they still, it was probably a tourist thing, they still emphasize voodoo down there. But that came from Haiti. And the majority of slaves sold to America came from the Caribbean. Well, what was the African religion in America? What was the slave religion in America? Well, we need to look at it in a couple periods. First, we should look at the colonial period. Remember, this time in America was English rule. So there weren't states yet. There were English colonies. And one justification of slavery was to spread the gospel. You remember Matthew 28:19, go ye therefore and teach all nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father and the Son and of the Holy Spirit. But that was really pretty weak. They were not real interested in that. The reason why they had slaves was for their economic benefit. For free labor, well, it wasn't really free because they had to buy the slaves and it was considered to be property. But the slave owners were not actively obeying Jesus' commandment. They were rather apathetic about it. Their economic interests were their priority. And slave owners were concerned that baptism and the tenets of Christianity would foster some belief of an equality between white and blacks. And this would interfere with the slaveholders' ability to control the slaves. So that's another reason why they held back from teaching and baptizing their slaves. But from 1664 to 1706, beginning in Maryland, there were at least six colonial legislators that passed acts denying that baptism altered the condition of bondage. So they put into law that slaves could not escape bondage by being baptized and accepting the Christian faith. Well, next came along, as we talked in the first session, about the First Great Awakening. And the northern slaveholders, the Puritans, they were urgently trying to convert the Negro souls. There was that millennial hope, too, in that latter part of the era of a purified America, of a purified new world for Christianity, and how God held that area as a favored nation for Christianity. And so they urged eradicating slavery to come more quickly through legislation after the Revolution. And by passing, they weren't really able to pass, though, legislation within their own denominations, like Protestantism was divided into primarily the Presbyterians in the North and the Congregationalists. Later in the South, Methodism and Baptist came into being. But those churches would become divided if they addressed slavery very strongly. The only thing that Presbyterians seemed to do, it was to believe in education and preparing them for freedom, teaching them maybe some factors or trades that would help them to create a living after they were freed. In the South, the First Great Awakening hit the South a little differently. The South said that the institution of slavery did not anger God, but it was the bad slave owners who angered God. So the Southern focus was on converting individual slave owners to freeing their slaves, or at least being better slaveholders and treating them better. They were against the practice of dividing slave families. They tried to teach them to keep them together and not teaching them the tenets of their own faith. Remember, settlers to the southern areas were not motivated by religious freedom. This is another big difference from the south that I think should make us a little less punitive to the actions of the south toward slavery. They were settled not by the Puritans that had that same ethic of freedom of religion. The people who came to the south from Maryland and downward were coming for economic reasons, for new opportunities. They weren't motivated for religious freedom. So when missionaries were assigned to minister to the slaves, they were thwarted by the owners in their efforts. For instance, Francis Asbury, who was one of the founders of Methodism here in the United States, wrote in his journal in 1798, "I am brought to conclude that slavery will exist in Virginia perhaps for ages. There is not a sufficient sense of religion nor of liberty to destroy it." Then 11 years later, in 1809, he was lamenting the anti-slavery reputation of the Methodists was keeping them from gaining access to the slaves. "The blacks are deprived of the means of instructions. Who will take the pains to lead them into the ways of salvation and watch over them that that may not stray but the Methodists? Now their masters will not let them come near us." So in the antebellum period before the Civil War, Rabideau calls this the invisible institution of slave religion. It had to happen out of sight of the white slavers. The slavery's method of control were to eradicate all forms of African culture that unified people, their language, their tribal units, their family connections. They also had the tactic of demoralizing individuals. Physical hardship, lack of rest, poor diet, humiliating punishment, and verbal abuse. These were all ways that the white slave owner kept the black people without a self-esteem that could rise to rebelling and could erupt in physical rebellion. They were terrified of slave rebellions, the white people. So the black people were then under the somewhat influence of their religion. They were told that they could come to church, but they were relegated either to the back of the church or to the balconies behind the white people. So, and the teaching of the Christian tenets was rather limited in their preaching to the blacks. The blacks could have their own religious ceremonies, their Sundays. In the afternoon, sometimes the slaveholders would bring in a preacher. It would be a white preacher. And they preached on the New Testament texts of honor and obey your master, such as in Paul's letter to Onesimus in Philemon, the book of Philemon, and Paul's encouragement for slaves to obey their masters. This is in several places in Paul's letters to Christian settlements in the New Testament. But they really limited to encourage peace and discourage discontent and rebellion. Don't steal. Don't steal from your owners. Don't lie to your owners, but do obey your masters. That was about the depth of the preaching. But still, when they got a black preacher, it was heaven for them. Because the blacks, some of them who could learn, who did learn to read, could read the Bible and what it really said. But what were the slave reactions to this white Christianity? And were they able to establish black churches? Well, this invisible institution, Rabideau pored over the archives for accounts of how enslaved and freed people had lived. They resisted white oppression and developed their own culture. So he's looking at religion from the black point of view, not as historians had from the white people looking at what the blacks were doing. If blacks were found, they would, you've heard of this night stealaways, steal away to Jesus. They would sing that hymn, and that was a covert clue that they should gather at night that night in their well-known spot where they could pray by themselves together and out of sight and out of hearing of their owners. One of the ways that, another way that the owners controlled the slave movement to prevent slave rebellion was to set aside, they weren't allowed their slaves to move very much, but they still managed it because some of the slaves were hired out. It was another way for economic gain by the white slaveholders if they didn't happen to need all the slaves he had for his farm or plantation. He would lead them out, lend them out on a short-term basis to other white farmers or there's my senior moment again. What do we think always of the South? They don't have farms, they have... Thank you. So, but they were away. They went with their owners too to different cities and close by locations. They met, so they had a chance to meet with other other slaves. And as I said, the two, they had these nighttime stealaways. And also they could have some sort of quiet or prayer meetings in their own cabins. I also read in some of the WPA, this was the Depression era, Roosevelt acts to employ people during the Great Depressions. They sent writers out to get slave testimonies and hear about what their life was like. And they this was in 1936, so they could at least talk to very old slaves in their 80s and 90s for their childhood remembrances of what how they worshiped. And some of them would remember that they would put buckets or kettles over their heads and pray and sing so that their voices would be muted and their owners wouldn't hear it. But they were very spirited and they wanted to be loud and they wanted to pray with these voices that were fervent. And that's what they needed to keep secret about it. One of the big things that they, the blacks, were highly critical of white Christianities and in the established churches is they saw how hypocritical it was. They were told not to steal, but yet some of the slaves were told to go steal from another farm close by. Page 295. Excuse me while I find the page. Charles Brown, a fugitive slave from Virginia, claimed that he had expressed the same argument, this duplicity of stealing, to his own master. "I told my master one day," said I, "you white folks set the bad example of stealing. You stole us from Africa. And not content with that, if any got free, you stole them afterward. And so they were made slaves again." And according to George Womble, who had been a slave in Georgia, slaves were taught to steal by their masters. Sometimes they were sent to the nearby plantations to steal chickens, pigs, and other things that could be carried away easily. At such times, the master would tell them that he was not going to mistreat them and that he was not going to allow anyone to mistreat them, and that by taking the above-mentioned things, they were helping him to be more able to take care of them, the slaves. Lying. Lying was another religious tenet that they were preached to, and there was a man by the name of John Brown, the slave, not the one who led slaves to rebellion. John Brown explained in his narrative to readers who might not understand the ethical system by which slave lived, "In fact, we felt we were living under a system of cheating and lying and deceit, and we did not see the wrong of it so long as we were not acting against one another." I am sure that, as a rule, any one of us who would have thought nothing of stealing a hog or a sack of corn from our master would have allowed himself to be cut to pieces, meaning flogged, rather than betray the confidence of his fellow slave. The principle us against them, the in-group use of indirect and development of mass to conceal the true feelings, was essential to the slave's own moral system. It was a way of preserving their own sense of dignity that they developed these different moralities toward the whites, because the whites had a different morality that was not reflected in the Bible, toward them. They also had something called the trickster, the briar rabbit, and putting on old massa. They would make these stories up that would be hilarious to them, but the white masters, they wouldn't understand them. So they could get away with saying certain things to their masters, which was really derogatory and insulting, but they would have no idea what they were talking about. So what came about was in this flexibility or adaptability in the religious minds of African Americans, they would blend elements of the African activity with what they were experiencing in the white churches and in their own churches. On page 282 describes this. It's called conjuring. This man by the name of they called Dickey. Dickey held everyone on the plantation, white or black, in his power. Able to come and go at his pleasure, he never worked. No one interfered with him, Dickey hunted, slept, was at the table at mealtime, roamed through the woods, went to the city, and returned whenever he pleased. Everybody treated him with respect, even the white ladies who sought him out for love potions and forecasts of romance. When a new overseer, unfamiliar with the Dickey status, tried to force him to work in the fields, Dickey, by some secret means, set him straight. His power, it was rumored, came from his being in league with Satan. Whatever the source of his power, it was clear to all that Dickey was his own master. There were other conjurers, there were other exploits. The conjurer became a folk character. Stories which told of his resourcefulness, independence, power were a source of vicarious pleasure to slaves whose own independence and power were so severely restricted. So it's another way that they made meaning in their life, through religion. Whether you believe in the power that they felt they had, whether the power of the devil was active in their lives or of God that was active in their lives. Nothing challenged the credibility of the conjurer as much as his claim that he could conjure white folks. Whether whites were susceptible to conjure was problematic, as the testimony of slaves reveal. There also developed something that they called the ring shout. It was sort of a compromise with the Methodists who were, the blacks were attached to more Methodist experience of worship because they were more lively. My mother grew up in the town of Monaca. Across the alley from them was the Methodist church, and she remembers them and talked kind of derisively about the Methodist singing. It was just a little bit too lively for her Presbyterian taste. So it just keeps carrying over the generations. But the Methodist, they would allow the blacks to worship themselves and develop their own worship styles, but they forbid them to dance in their worship. That was going too far. On most of the rice plantations, which I have seen in this vicinity, this is a man by the name of Olmsted talking about the slave worship. There is a small chapel, which the Negroes call their prayer house. The owner of one of these slaves told me that having furnished the prayer house with seats, having a back rail, his Negroes petitioned them to remove it because it did not leave enough room for them to pray. Obviously, they weren't praying sitting down. It was explained to me that it is their custom in social worship to work themselves up to a great pitch of excitement in which they could yell and cry out, and finally shriek and leap up, clapping their heads, hands, and dancing, as it had done at heathen festivals. So the back rail, they found, was a serious impediment to this exercise. So they took the best of what they were offered and made better of it by incorporating what they wanted to do. They weren't afraid of rebelling in that sense. And there's another scholar, African-American, Eugene Genovese, a historian of American slavery. Enslaved people preferred the Baptist and Methodist churches because these two interpretations of Christianity had a fiery style and uninhibited emotionalism. We had, who was it from the Christian, from Swickley, mental health group that our counseling center is a part of now.
Samaritan.
Pardon me?
Samaritan.
Samaritan Counseling Center, right. And what was the name of the minister who,
Graham
Standish, right, okay. Graham Standish, in explaining varieties of religious experiences, told the difference between more intellectual churches and beliefs, such as Presbyterians and Episcopalians, versus more emotional or spirited worship. And he would quote the, would refer to the, he would refer to a group of African-American at churches who had more lively singing and more experiencing, just like the soldiers did during the war, their experience sharing of how God had influenced their life. Methodists did not allow dancing, as I said before. They believed it to be a sinful behavior. So instead of dancing, enslaved people were satisfied with shouting. So, more in conclusion, and we're coming down to the end of our hour, how did slaves and free Negroes make meaning for their lives? It was through religion. They incorporated a lot of their practices within their religion that probably we white people wouldn't consider to be religious. But they offered, religion offered them a social sphere within enslaved communities that relieved experiences of dehumanization under slavery. White people were not watching them when they were in their own communities. So they preached and discussed their own interpretations of the Bible during secret services and meetings. According to Mary Gladdy, a former enslaved person in Georgia, it was customary among slaves during the Civil War period to secretly gather in their cabins two or three nights each week and hold prayer and experience meetings. During these meetings, Gladdy explained how they talked with one another about their experiences. They shook hands and chanted canticles together. Through these acts, the people on Gladys' plantation fostered a community. They also saw in Jesus a person who had a shared experience that was, in a sense, comparable to slavery. I remember seeing that movie Amadeus, and there was a black man, one of the leaders of the mutiny on that slave ship, where they were arrested when they reached land and put in jail. This man had been given a Bible by probably a Puritan. This was early in time period. And it was illustrated. So there were pictures of Jesus's life. And the slave remarked, not in English, it was in subtitles. I forget the exact quote. But he recognized Jesus as getting a raw deal. Jesus had been subjected to an injustice, falsely accused and betrayed by his friends. The slave saw that in the pictures of Jesus. Also, slaves took a great solace in the idea of heaven and the future. In this heaven, there was great retribution of the whites by the blacks. There was a great reversal of conditions. There were blacks and whites in heaven, but the blacks were the ones who had dominion over the whites. Roles were reversed. They believed in a just God. So then that meant that slaves who had already lived through hell in their life here on earth, but they would see that the slaveholders faced eternal punishment. So maybe they wouldn't even see their black masters in heaven. This concept of reversal was reinforced by the witnessing of slaves when their masters were on their deathbeds. It was usual for the slaves to be called up on such occasions when their masters were afraid of dying and facing death to say that they forgive them for what they had done. So we come to think their minds just be dreadful uneasy about holding slaves. All this may seem to be trifling, but it is the truth, and I only give what I have myself experienced. This man's observation is certainly not trifling. For slaves to perceive their master's guilt-filled dread and to see him begging for their prayers and forgiveness vindicated their belief in final retribution and demonstrated not only their moral superior to whites, but also a serious measure of psychological and emotional control over them. In the slaves' moral judgment, ministers in particular were deserving of condemnation. The ministers used to tell us not to be disorderly on taking the sacrament, observed this James Sumler. I thought he was disorderly himself for keeping slaves. So they saw through it, but in order to survive, in order to keep their families together as much as they could, they subjected themselves and they were quiet, but they rebelled and they found ways of speaking back in ways that wouldn't get them into trouble. Let me pause here. I'm running out of saliva in my mouth. I forgot my water today. But do you have questions or comments? You have good questions, I remember, from the previous sessions. Jay, again.
I live not that far from West Middleton, Pennsylvania. On 844 going towards West Virginia, there's a little town that's very old. And apparently it was a railroad town for slaves. But one day I just walked the graveyard there and stumbled across some Civil War veterans, color troops, so marked on their gravestones, which was really cool. And Nat Youngblood's also buried there. Really made me curious about these fellas, and I brought it up to a person near in town, and she said that there are still some families from that period that were black. Just a neat thing to see.
Thanks for that. We'll be talking. Speaking of graves, we'll be talking a little bit more about what happened to the slaves and the white soldiers after the war.
I have a question. Most of the slaves that came into the States, you said, were from the Caribbean. They had their own traditions and their own beliefs way back. Where did the Bible fit in with the slaves? Were they given access to the Bible? And is it stereotypical to say that most of the slaves are Baptists? That's sort of the impression you have today, at least in the South, that that most of the blacks are part of the Baptist Church, and I don't know how it was back then. So it's really two things: is the Bible at all involved? Did they have access to the Bible, and that was that core to their beliefs, or did they just sort of hang on to traditions and came up with their own form of Christianity?
The first question about did blacks have access to the Bible? There weren't really too many people, white or black, who had access to Bibles, at least during my research during the Civil War. And they didn't have the printing presses, I think, was one of the reasons. And no, the whites would not have given blacks Bibles, except there were white people, white Christians, who taught blacks a better form of Christianity. They were truer to their understanding of what the Bible really said. There were black preachers. Some of them were illiterate, but they would memorize the Bible. Somebody would have read the Bible to them, and they would memorize that, and then they would preach using those memorizations. There were many slave owners. There were white slave owners who did teach blacks to read and write. So if they did happen to get a Bible, they would read the Bible for themselves. And of course, the black preachers who could read were much better at teaching the true Christianity that wasn't the limited type of what they usually got from the white preachers. The second question, were they always Baptist? No, I had that impression too before I started reading more. And the Methodists were more prominent than the blacks in the South, I think. Those were the two denominations, Protestant denominations, that the blacks were attracted by.
I've also seen a lot of the presence of the AME church
Yes.
in the black community.
Yes, and AME stands for African Methodist Episcopal Church. So Richard Allen was one of the first, he may have been one of the founders, or at least not least the founder of the AME Church in Philadelphia. And he was originally part of the Asbury group of converted blacks and educated blacks. And he liked the structure of the Methodist Church. He felt that they were more adaptable and it was easier to form newer churches than the Baptists. So that's why he eventually left the Methodist Church, because they were limiting him in mission work with the Africans, with the slaves. But Richard Allen used the Methodist structure in the AME Church. Those are good questions. John?
From an economic standpoint, it seems like slavery was the foundation for wealth in the South. I mean, if it weren't for slaves, the slaveholders would not have been able to have the great wealth that they had. That appears to me. Why wouldn't that also be true in the North?
Because they had different types of industry. In the South, it was agricultural. And the type of workers that you needed were unskilled. And when the Africans came over, they were unskilled. All new labor brought in any decade or any time period, new workers are always unskilled. When I left business to go to the church, I was unskilled. I could not transfer my managerial business skills to the church. I had to start from scratch. And one of the big things about when you learn in economics is that labor is so untransferable. They don't want to move. And, well, the Caribbean and America, these were new worlds. They didn't have enough people to produce all of the sugar and the gold and whatever the Caribbean was doing, and the rice and the cotton and the tobacco that the South was doing. They needed slaves. They needed people who they can work. They needed labor that could be controlled. Labor is still controlled in our society. They use different methods, but they still are.
It's kind of hard for us to conceive of how powerful and how huge the economic impact was with the growth of cotton and sugar in the United States, which was uniquely designed or uniquely naturally to make certain strains of cotton, things like that. The amount of money and wealth that was created so rapidly because of the European markets is by modern standards, it's hard for us to even conceive. I'm seeing like relative dollar amounts in today's dollars in certain time periods, and that required a huge amount of labor. There was nothing else that they could be done. The idea was that they could conceive that these people were uniquely designed for these harsh environments, therefore that we needed all of that. But that amount of wealth was huge and very rapid.
That's a very good explanation, good point you made. And I wanted to focus simply on religion. That was enough of a thing to swallow. But it is difficult to appreciate the reasons for slavery when you don't know the economics. And also how different the white settlers in the North were from the white settlers in the South. Different. One reason why slaves were not given a great deal of teaching about Christianity is because the white churches in the South lacked staff. So, anyway. Anyway, yes, Jeff.
Just a comment on what you said earlier about black preachers. You're absolutely right. These preachers could not read or write, but their memories must have been tremendous because, as you said, they taught the scripture strictly from memory.
I think one thing I've learned, I've come to really appreciate that there are all kinds of intelligence. And I think the blacks were geniuses in many ways by using their intelligence in ways that they could. They couldn't, because of the oppression, so many avenues were closed to them. But if we were to go forward, and I don't have any background on this, but on Reconstruction, a lot of blacks, for instance, there was one woman who was a seamstress. She became famous and had her own store, even though this was before emancipation. She made Mary Todd Lincoln's wedding dress. She made wedding dresses for the richest people in the South.
She was in very high demand, had a waiting list.
Uh-huh. So, any other comments? Well, tell me what you want to hear next week. I'm a little short on material, but I'll find stuff. So thank you very much for your attention.